the third case of the day, Environmental Barrier v. Slurry Systems. Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Your Honor. Eric Rowe on behalf of the appellant Slurry Systems. This case involves an appeal of an order confirming an arbitration award. In considering an arbitration, in a case involving arbitration cases, an agreement to arbitrate is first and foremost a matter of contract between parties. That means that the court, in considering the agreement to arbitrate, must treat it as a contract. And that has really two ramifications that we need to talk about today here. The first is that the court must determine for itself whether a contract exists between the parties. And the second, the court must determine whether the contract has been performed.
Could I ask you, Mr. Rowe, I mean, it seems to me that maybe one of the most important things we need to do in this case is to reconcile First Options of Chicago against Kaplan with Buckeye check cashing. Those seem to be the two cases that are the banner cases for each of you. Obviously, First Option says, you know, we don't have the usual deference to arbitration if we're at the preliminary question, is there actually an agreement between these parties? And Buckeye says an arbitration provision is severable, and unless the challenge is to the clause, the contract's validity as a whole is for the arbitrator. Now, you've made some arguments, such as your argument under 365, that really go to whether, you know, it seemed to me to go to the issue of the contract's validity as a whole, and I'm not sure how, I'd be interested to know how you think we should weave our way through these two different sets of instructions from the Supreme Court.
The difference between the Buckeye case and this case is in Buckeye, the parties to that case had originally contracted with each other. We don't have that here. The parties.
So
to
do
the,
you think you have a contract at all with now Environmental Barrier?
Unless the requirements of Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code have been met, and they have not been met, there is no contract between Slurry Systems and Environmental Barrier.
So what's the what? I mean, there are some interesting things about the 365 issue, but what I'm concerned about is, I suppose, the fact that in the bankruptcy, as I understand this, the contract with Geocon was considered an asset of the bankruptcy estate, and it was assigned or, in a sense, sold as an asset to Environmental Barrier. Is that correct?
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, it was an executory contract, a contract for
so
services.
You argue.
Well, it is a contract for services to be performed, and it was treated that way,
but
both by Environmental Barrier.
Don't get
and
too
GMI.
Far ahead of us here, because what I'm interested in is when a contract itself is, I'll just use the word assigned, because I think that's easier to deal with, and the contract has an arbitration clause in it, and we know from Buckeye that arbitration provisions are severable. What authority is there, one way or the other, to say that a new agreement to arbitrate springs up between the assignee and the original party, the other party to the contract?
Well, it's not a new agreement to arbitrate, Your Honor, because the agreement to arbitrate is contained in the larger overall contract.
And so are you willing to say if there's a contract at all, you have to arbitrate with these people?
If there is a contract that has, if EBC has become a party to the contract with Slurry Systems, the arbitration clause would come into play.
Because what the district court focuses on at the top of page 7, which is at A8 in your appendix, she recognizes this is a new question. She says neither party has presented the court with any authority on the issue of whether a party who's the successor to a party to an arbitration agreement can enforce the arbitration agreement. That's the issue that bothers me about this case.
Well,
because, frankly, it looks to me like whether this is executory or not, most of this work had been done. Maybe there was a little bit of tail end work, but our court has looked to whether it's principally executory or not, and it seems to be mostly done. But if we stumble at the threshold and there isn't really an agreement between Slurry and environmental barrier. That's a whole different question. That might be a first options kind of question.
Right, and our contention is, Your Honor, that first options applies and Buckeye does not apply for precisely that reason. Environmental Barrier Company didn't even exist when this contract was created between Geocon and Slurry Systems. And so the issue then is, did Environmental Barrier become a party to that contract through whatever mechanism was there? That is an issue for the court. Outside of bankruptcy, it might be just a straight question of assignment. And if it's a straight question of assignment, then you get into whether or not the contract prohibited assignment and so forth. But in bankruptcy, there are specific additional requirements that come into play before Environmental Barrier can become a party to the contract.
Let me ask you this. If we disagreed with you and we thought that those prerequisites had in fact been satisfied under the bankruptcy laws, under 365 and whatever other bankruptcy law may be pertinent, would you lose?
Your Honor, if the requirements of Section 365 have been met, that is that they have cured all the defaults, the existing defaults, and they have given the adequate assurances of future performance such that they have become a party to the contract, then they would be a party to the contract and there would be an arbitration agreement that would be in existence between
right,
the parties.
Right, but you have not quite answered my question because your answer assumed that 365 applied and the arbitrator and the district court didn't see this as a 365 kind of contract, didn't think it was still executory enough. And so at least some people have thought that it wasn't. And if we agreed with them, would you have any arguments left?
On that issue, I think not, on the first issue, Your Honor. But the specific question that we've raised here is that the district court actually did not decide that issue. The district court looked at what the arbitrator said and said, I have to give deference to the arbitrator, when in fact it was the district court who should have looked at the 365 issue and decided, is this contract executory? Have the requirements of Section 365 been met? And if so, is there an agreement to arbitrate here? The district court did not engage in that analysis, and the district court did not consider that issue.
Okay. And so I think another aspect of your argument, just to make sure I'm understanding it properly, is there's a line of cases that this court has, actually lots of courts have said this, that say when a court is engaging in that threshold inquiry about whether there is an agreement to arbitrate, sometimes it's impossible to avoid merits questions as well, and if you have to get into the merits, then so be it.
That's correct.
And you're relying on that.
Yes, ma'am.
Also, okay.
Yes. And so that's our first issue, is that the district court should have considered this issue. And if the district court has to get to the issue of whether there is a contract or not, that's what the district court has to decide. Because the question of whether a contract exists, an agreement to arbitrate exists between two parties, is always a question for the court to decide. It is never a question that can be deferred to the arbitrator, because the arbitrator does not have the power to establish his own.
Well, it's almost always. First options recognizes but I don't see anything in this arbitration agreement that would make it a question for the arbitrator.
That's right, Your Honor. And then our second argument, our third argument have kind of a related issue, which is in considering whether the agreement to arbitrate has been performed, which is the second thing that the court needs to decide. The court cannot substitute its own judgment for that of the arbitrator, because the parties have agreed upon on the arbitration. The court is there to decide whether that agreement to arbitrate has been fulfilled or not. And so it is not the role of the court to decide the arbitrator was right. It is not the role of the court to decide whether the arbitrator was wrong. The court obviously cannot consider the merits of what the arbitrator did and say, oh, he got it wrong. The court cannot also look at the merits and say the arbitrator got it right. The merits are not relevant here. The question is, what did the arbitrator do? And if the arbitrator was obligated to apply the contract, then the question is, did he apply the contract? And in this case, we know that he did not.
Well, except it looked to me, looking at this contract, that what the arbitrator did was he studied the contract, he derived from the contract a rule that there was supposed to be a relatively balanced allocation of costs and profits. Initially, the parties seemed to have thought that was going to be 58%, it turned out to be much lower. It seems to me a little odd, actually, because if the arbitrator had slavishly followed the words of the contract, you would have wound up having to give them 58%.
Not at all, Your Honor, because the 58% related to the original contract price. All of the money that's involved here and all the claims that are involved in this case related to changes to the prime contract, in which there are separate provisions in this contract that deal with changes to the prime contract and suspensions of work by the owner.
But is there ever a number that shows up in those change orders? Maybe you can direct me to one in the record because I didn't see one. But is there a, you know, Amendment 15, the split of costs and profits will now be, you know, 40% or something?
No, Your Honor, because that's not the way the changes worked.
Right.
The way the changes worked is that the subcontractor would give a price to the general contractor, and then he would be paid that price. That's part of the claims procedure that's in the subcontract itself. And behind and in the record behind the various modifications to the general contract are both Slurry System's submission to the owner and Geocon's submissions to Slurry Systems with respect to each of those changes. And that's the way that it worked in this respect in this contract with respect.
But if the arbitrator had gone shopping for a number, he was never going to find a number in this contract other than the original number, the 58%.
In the contract, but he would have found it in the evidence, certainly. Yeah, and so one of the things that the arbitrator relied upon in this case is in the first sentence of his reasoned award is the teaming agreement that existed prior to this contract coming into existence. This contract had in it, of course, a merger clause that said all prior agreements are superseded. It was therefore not allowable for the arbitrator to consider what the teaming agreement did and what it said about the relationship between these parties, because it was specifically excluded from this contract and therefore could not be considered by the arbitrator. And yet that's what he did.
But you're essentially, though, you're saying the arbitrator weighed the evidence incorrectly because the course of dealing based on all of these changes showed a different intent.
That
is the evidence, essentially, of what the parties were doing.
Well, the difference between interpreting the contract, which is what the arbitrator has to do, and the merits of finding, you know, some result from the evidence, may be a fine line at some point, but what the court has to look at is whether the arbitrator interpreted the contract. And that, you look at the contract, you look at what the arbitrator's ruling was, did he interpret the contract to get there? And if there's no overlap between the contract and the award, like in this case, then you can tell that the arbitrator did not interpret the contract. And when you have a reasoned award in this case, like in this case, where the arbitrator relied upon the prior agreement that had been superseded by the merger agreement, when he relied upon testimony of one of the parties as to what would be fair, and when he relied upon a procedure that the parties engaged to with respect to something other than what was at issue, final payment, he was not relying upon the terms of the contract. He was not applying the contract to get to the result in this case. And that's what the arbitrator did wrong.
Mr. Rowe, are you familiar with a case called Flender Corporation against Techniquip?
Yes, sir.
It was decided by this court back in 92.
I've read the case, Your Honor.
Why isn't it applicable to the situation here?
Because in this particular case, what is before the court, I mean, this case does not involve a review of the merits of what the arbitrator did. And you can't look at the case to say the arbitrator got this right. You can't look at this and say the arbitrator got wrong. The question is, did the arbitrator interpret the contract? Did he apply the terms of the contract to what was at issue in this case? Okay. Now, our third issue that we've raised, I'll just say very briefly, related to the same issue, that the court cannot substitute its judgment for that of the arbitrator, and that's what the court did wrong in the third part of it, in deciding that it would have changed the outcome of the arbitration. That was not for the district court to decide. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Mr. Sewell?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Anthony Sillo, and I have the privilege and responsibility of representing Environmental Barrier in this appeal. And I'd like to begin, Your Honor, if I may, by at least taking a stab at reconciling first options with Buckeye. First Options, of course, asks the question whether there's an agreement to arbitrate. And here the district court did three things to satisfy herself that there was. First, she asked whether or not Slurry Systems agreed to arbitrate all disputes arising under the subcontract. Clearly it did. There's no dispute to the contract.
I don't think there's any doubt that if Geocon were still the party, there's an agreement to arbitrate.
Secondly, the district court asked herself whether there was an assignment of the right to enforce the arbitration provision. Clearly here there was as well. There is a bill of sale by which EBC paid money to acquire the subcontract, and the subcontract included the arbitration clause.
But
the district court went, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The assignment clause of the contract, everybody has been reading it as though it only has one part to it. I'm talking about 7.4.2. But the assignment clause of the contract says the subcontractor, number one, shall not assign the work of this subcontract without the written consent of the contractor, fine, nor subcontract the whole of this subcontract without the written consent of the contractor. And so it in and of itself seems to say when an assignment happens, you have to at most get consent of the other party to the contract, here Slurry, or at least tell them. And I honestly, the part about this case that worries me the most is this very threshold issue. Is there the kind of transfer of this contract to Environmental Barrier that is enough to signify that there's an agreement to arbitrate between Slurry and Environmental Barrier? There certainly was plenty for Geocon, but without telling them, without anything, arbitration is a creature of agreement. The Supreme Court tells us that over and over again. And when there's no agreement, I mean, I'm not saying this about your client, but somebody might be perfectly happy to have an arbitration agreement with company number one, who they know to be a reputable company. But then if company number one is either duped or otherwise, you know, assigns it to somebody who's run by the mafia, you know, they may not be so happy to arbitrate, or maybe just because it's a brand new startup company and there's no track record. I can think of thousands of reasons why a company might not want an arbitration agreement, and with no aspersions to anyone. So, and then I look at the language of this assignment clause. It says you can't subcontract the whole of the subcontract, whatever that is. It's, that means something other than the work of the subcontract, surely.
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I think what
so
it means...
So it's redundant?
I think in a sense it's redundant, because what I think it means is you can't simply subcontract out all of your work under the agreement. And so in that sense, I do believe it's redundant. Keep in mind here that all of the work had been completed.
But that's the first part of this, the work of the subcontract. And I agree. See, if we get beyond this threshold, I think you're making persuasive arguments about 365 and, you know, there was a little bit, you know, tail end cleaning up sort of thing. So in that sense, executory, but largely not executory. The work had been done. Whether the arbitrator drew his award from the contract or exceeded his powers, I understand those arguments. But it's this threshold question that really bothers me about whether we can say that there's an agreement to go to an arbitral procedure.
Well, I think, Your Honor, perhaps some of the cases which deal with a radically different situation, an arguably more difficult one, where you have somebody who you're trying to enforce an arbitration clause against a non-signatory. That's not what we have here. Clearly, we have someone that did, in fact, agree to arbitrate the dispute, and the only dispute is one of payment. There are no other issues in terms of work performed. In fact,
well, somebody different, though, not the person you're arbitrating with. Slurry didn't agree ever with Environmental Barrier to do anything.
Well, but it agreed to pay the amount that's appropriately due, Your Honor, and that's the only issue that's here.
But we're talking about forum, though. We're not talking about substantive duty. I presume the Circuit Court of Cook County, or, you know, if there were diversity, the Northern District, any number of people could have evaluated whether the work was done, whether payment was due, you know, all of that stuff. That's garden variety dispute. But the forum is the whole question here.
No, and I understand the significance of that, Your Honor, and I think the district court was correct in interpreting the subcontract as permitting that assignment. Because
there's almost no law. Did you find anything else? She cites one Northern District of Illinois case from 2002. She cites an Eastern District of Wisconsin case from 1989. which itself cited a 1960 Second Circuit case. That's it.
I did not find anything else, Your Honor. But so there is obviously limited authority. And then I think what you do is fall back on the overriding policies in the Arbitration Act itself, which is to arbitrate when parties agree to arbitrate a dispute.
When the parties agree. But that's why I get back to first options versus
no, Buckeye. And I understand. Yeah. And that's why I was trying to put the cases together.
Yeah.
And you appropriately hit me at the point where arguably there's arguments that can be made both ways. I do, however, believe that the provision in this so-called anti-assignment clause, and keep in mind that under Illinois law, those are strictly construed. And so it's one thing to try and, I don't want to use the wrong word, it's one thing to create an argument based on the language. It's yet another thing to determine that that language is sufficiently clear and specific so as to preclude an assignment. And I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that the language in that agreement does not do that. Moreover, Your Honor, the subcontract itself contemplates that other parties who are non-signatory could participate in an arbitration proceeding. This arbitration clause also contains a consolidation provision, which indicates that a party with a significant interest in the outcome can, in fact, participate even though he or she or it is not a signatory to the contract.
But, you know, I mean, you well know that saying that somebody may participate is quite different from saying they're forced to and would be subject to a motion to dismiss if they tried to bring a suit in court. I'm not sure that your clause goes that far, and I don't know how it could, frankly, going back to the fundamental nature of arbitration is something that happens by agreement.
Your Honor, I do want to address one other point that you made, and that is whether there was a basis. You didn't see any basis in the arbitration provision for the exception to first options to apply. And I believe that you were referring to the exception where the parties agree that the threshold question of whether or not
of arbitrability
goes to the arbitrator.
Yes.
And, Your Honor, I think that there is here. And admittedly, it wasn't raised in my brief, and let me tell you why. If you look at the arbitration clause here, it states that any claim arising out of or related to the subcontract. Now, that's language which this court in Sphere Drake, a case cited in their brief, recognized as being the broadest possible arbitration clause. And that very clause was used by the United States Supreme Court in Prima Paint to constitute an agreement to submit contract formation issues to the arbitrator. And so, Your Honor, even though it wasn't raised in my brief, since you'd asked the question, I feel compelled to advise the court that I believe there is an independent basis on which to affirm the district court, and that is based on the breadth of this arbitration clause. In fact, it has been interpreted in the past as being broad enough to constitute an agreement to submit threshold questions of contract formation to the arbitrator. And after all, that is what was done here. The arbitrator was asked to determine that issue. He did determine it. And in fact, the arbitrator was asked to determine whether there were any defaults under the subcontract. This gets to the Section 365 issue. That was a substantive counterclaim that was raised. And the arbitrator decided that the counterclaim was rejected. And that aspect of the ruling, Your Honor, has not been the subject of any appeal to the district court. For instance, Slurry Systems didn't argue that the arbitration award was invalid because the counterclaim was rejected. The notion that there are no defaults, Your Honor, respectfully, moots out the issue as to whether there was an executory contract or whether there was a duty to cure, because the determination that there were no faults means there were no duty to cure any defaults, and you don't have to even get to the issue of executory contract. On the merits, Your Honor, unless the court has other questions on the threshold question.
Well, I wondered what your take on the Flender Corporation case was. You cited it at page 32 of your brief for an ancillary point, but I wonder why it doesn't speak to the question you've just addressed as well.
The jurisdictional issue, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid I have to concede that I don't recall the jurisdictional aspect of the Flender case. You're right, I did cite it for the basis that I was going to move to next, which is that the courts are sort of loath to permit someone to challenge an arbitration appeal by using the phrase that it's exceeded their powers. And, Your Honor, here I think the record clearly shows that the arbitrator did not exceed his powers because, after all, he did interpret the subcontract. The subcontract created a framework by which the parties agreed to share the profits on the job based on their proportional share of the direct costs incurred in performing the prime contract work. Now, obviously, the subcontract estimated or projected that cost share was going to be 58% 42%, but that turned out not to be the case, and there was language, as the district court correctly observed, in the subcontract which stated that the final payments would be adjusted in accordance with the way in which the parties actually incurred the direct costs. As it turned out, Geocon incurred 44% of the direct costs, and the arbitrator based his decision on that specific point. This is not a case where the arbitrator split the baby. We had actually argued that Geocon, and then therefore EBC, was entitled to a 50% share based on the theory that there was a duty of good faith and fair dealing to keep the costs in that proportional range, which had been breached. The arbitrator rejected that claim and said, no, it's not 50%. It's based on what the framework of the contract intended, 44-56, and that's the basis of the award. And, in fact, the evidence shows that the other side actually agreed with that profit split, because during the last meeting, there was a profit allocation to Geocon, which was withheld as retention in the amount of, I think it was more than $163,000, which was based on this 44% split. And so the arbitrator simply followed the form of the contract, and he followed the course of the parties' dealings in performing the contract. It was perfectly legitimate for him to do so, and it was appropriate for the district court. And reviewing this decision under the incredibly deferential standard, to agree that the arbitrator did in fact interpret the contract. The last issue, Your Honor, that I think was raised concerns the document that was not produced, and I realize my opponents didn't get an opportunity to raise that issue here, but I'll address it anyway, since it is an issue that's before the court. They argued essentially that the district court applied the wrong standard in rejecting their Rule 59 motion. And I submit to you that the Rule 59 standards encompass within it the standard that they claim should have been applied. They claim that what the district court should have determined is whether the arbitration award was procured by a fraud. And one of the elements for that is that in this case, the missing document must be materially related to an issue in the case. Here, the district court determined that the evidence was not material because it was cumulative and because the arbitration award was not based on the $711,000 receivable. And so the entire issue was one big red herring from the beginning, and this piece of cumulative evidence has really had no impact whatsoever on the decision of the arbitrator as recognized by the district court. If there are no other questions from the bench, I will finish. Let me thank you for the opportunity to argue before this court. It's my first occasion, and I appreciate it.
Mr. Rowe?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. I think I only need to make one point. With regard to the first options case, the court held that if the parties have clearly and unmistakably given the arbitrator the power to decide arbitrability questions, then the arbitrator has that power. But who decides whether parties have clearly and unmistakably given the arbitrator that power? The court does. So the court ultimately always must determine whether or not the agreement of the parties has empowered the arbitrator to do anything. And that's what we have here. The district court was required to decide whether or not the arbitrator had any power by whether there was even a contract between the parties.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.